So, Dave, I just flash on a fantastic memory, probably one of my most pleasant memories of doing panels at comic conventions together with the Webcomics Weekly crew. Okay. All four of us were there, so it had to have been San Diego. And this guy came up to ask a question. We had a microphone in the middle of the room. He came up to ask a question, and he was cosplaying Batman. But his suit was just a little tight, was just a little snug in the pants for this Batman. And he asked his question, and you got on the mic, and you said, well, one question that we just got answered today was we found out whether Batman dresses left. And it was such a fantastic line. It was and delivered so dryly. Every now and again, I just flash on that memory and just crack myself up.
God, that's amazing. Yeah. That's unlike me to make a sex joke in public. So that's funny that I do remember that outfit, though. Like, you absolutely saw everything there was to know about Bruce Wayne in that outfit. You're like, oh, yeah. I know too much about the Batcave at this point.
you definitely could see his Batawang.
Oh, God, Batawang. Oh, Brad. Brad, you know what? I'm going to captain that one. Batawang. Oh, jeez, Louise. All right, well, that's been Comic Lab for this week, everybody. Have a great week.
We're not going to go any better than that. We just hit 100.
That's either the most dad joke ever or the best joke ever. And I'm too much in my dadness that I can't tell anymore.
Yeah, that's a dad joke for when you're... Oh, God, that's so great. So my kids are old enough, I can start telling them dirty jokes within reason. Like, not super dirty jokes, but like kind of like... I tell them a joke that involves sex, and it's the great... So, can I tell you a joke?
Okay, here we go.
There's Dave's resigned voice.
I'm already blushing, just so you know.
No,
I'm already blushing.
This is a joke I told to my kids, and it's got sex in it, so they think it's like a big thing, right? So this person gets a call that their 95-year-old grandfather is in the hospital with a heart attack. And it goes rushing to the hospital, talks to grandma, who's also 95, and says, oh my gosh, grandma, what happened? She says, well, like every Sunday, we were having sex. And the guy goes, wait a minute, at 95 years old, you're having sex? She says, oh, sweetie, we have sex every Sunday. It's a beautiful tradition. And because we're up there in age, we've determined that we can time our movements to the church bells. Ding, dong, ding. And it's just in, out, in. And it's a beautiful, between two loving people. She says, of course we have sex on Sundays. We time it to the church bells. She took a moment, wiped a tear from her eye. She said, if that ice cream truck hadn't come down the road, he'd still be alive today.
Oh, God.
And that's what you get to look forward to. My kids are old enough now. I can tell them a quasi-dirty joke, and they just died. It was wonderful.
This joke brought to you by the Catskills in 1959.
That's part of what I love about it. It's such a borscht belt kind of punchline. That ice cream truck hadn't come down the road, he'd still be alive today. It's just got that rhythm I love so much.
Oh, God, that's amazing. the thing though about that bat outfit though is that
don't you want to talk about 95-year-old sex anymore? You're gonna take
it
back to Batman?
No, I don't. It's the short, and God bless us, we'll both be 95 at some point, but I don't want to talk about it even then.
So about this Batman cosplayer?
No, it's just I some of the cosplayers that we've had come up. The joy that has brought you and I as we have been boothing or tabling at a Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I almost want to pay some people. Like, you just created 3 days worth of joking with Brad and I.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So thank you for that outfit.
Thank you so much for you being you.
Yeah. You have brought me joy, cosplayer, and so I thank you.
That was some of my favorite memories. Just standing there at a San Diego Comic-Con table next to you. and just doing this running narration of what was going on in front of us during downtimes. It was that's the one part of comic conventions I think I'll miss the most, is just hanging out and doing that. You know, that was fun.
Well, don't forget, we're going to be doing NCS Fest in May. So
I know.
Anybody that wants to see what Brad and I do, joking the entire Comic-Con, just linger, yeah, just be a booth barnacle, and yeah. And you'll hear what Brad and I do all Comic-Cons whenever we booth together. So that'll be that. Anyway, all right. On that note, my friend, of 95-year-olds having sex and Batman's Wang, we're gonna warm it up here and say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. All right, so we're going to jump right into it this week. So I want to talk real quick about, this is kind of funny. Remember how last week or 2 weeks ago we were talking about our 2019 plans? I just wanted to clear one thing up. I forgot a book that I'm doing, an entire book that I'm doing. So remember how I said I'm going to do the Pop Culture Sheldon book and then I'm going to do the children's book. Both of that is true, but I forgot that there is a very strong possibility that if I finish it in time, I'm going to do my Anatomy of Authors book before the children book.
Yeah.
So just a quick clarification, because I know on last week's show, I was like, there's going to be something wrong if I won't have done that children's book in time. And I remembered as soon as I got off the show, oh, wait a minute, I forgot an entire project that I'm working on. And so Anatomy of Authors is this little like fake, each page is a new author and we sort of make fun of them in different unique ways. And that one might be done in time to kickstart that one in the fall versus the children's book. So we'll see which one wins out. In the fall, but one of those is going to be kickstarted.
That's such a great idea. And those anatomy books are really fun. And there's not a whole lot like that any place out there in the comics landscape. So you've really kind of carved out a little niche for yourself.
Yeah, it's. I think it'll be good. And it's really just a question. You don't want to overdo them like all at once because people come to Sheldon expecting a certain thing. And if you overload them with these anatomy comics, which I have at some point, you got to trickle them in. So that's the question of whether or not it'll be ready for fall, is that I can't do three of those a week, but I can do one of those a week. And then, you know, in so doing, get another 52 out of the year. But anyway, just wanted to clarify that. All right. So let's get into it. You had wanted to say and you had texted me very excited to tell me about Geiger's Law. Do you want to tell me about Geiger's Law?
And as a matter of fact, it's so wonderful because I don't think you knew I was going to talk about this. But you mentioned booth barnacles just a few minutes ago. And I think I'm going to have two contributions to web comics that are going to really outlast me, and that's the good news. Is after I die,
one is the smell. One is the smell.
Yeah. Oh, the smell is going to linger on. Believe me. Yeah. The
just a coffin lined with stick-em-ups, or what do they call them? What are they?
Stick-em-ups. This is a good place for a stick-em. Man, yeah, you're just dating yourself with that reference.
Sorry. Well, I apologize that I didn't use a Borscht Belt joke today. I'm sorry about that.
Well, there's still time. There's still time. We got lots of show. You can improve yourself at any time. No, I've got two things that are going to outlast me, and unfortunately, neither one of them is comics. But they're phrases. The first is Booth Barnacle, which you can see the first use of Booth Barnacle is in a Greystone Inn comic strip that goes way, way back to, before anyone used the term. And the second one I want to submit for posterity is Geiger's Law. And Geiger's Law is this: the first person who says that should be a print is the first person who's going to disappear when the merchandise is opened.
Oh, wow.
Right? And it works with prints, T-shirts, whatever type of merchandise. The first person who says, I had one person on Instagram just a couple months ago. One person said, I would buy that on a T-shirt for under $20. And I'm like,
and then as soon as you make it available, they're off to Mexico. Bye, well, buy that. Gotta go.
It just so happened I was at the computer the moment the little, I got the notification, right? And I was at the computer, had it on high res right in front of me. And I opened up Redbubble, put that sucker in. I had the link back in front of that guy within 5 minutes. Here it is, under $20, buy it. I haven't heard from him since.
And you never will. You know why? Because you turn around and you say to the guy, hey, I've got it in under 5 minutes. Here's the link. Go buy it. And you just turn around and it's suddenly like an old Western town with tumbleweeds. And you just hear off in the distance, wow, wow. And it's just no one is around. The guy has run off as fast as he can. Meanwhile, 10 minutes ago, he's like, Brad Geiger, I'm your biggest fan. Oh, I'd buy everything you ever made. I'm so excited. If you made this a print, I would buy it. Here you go. Here's the link. And he's just gone. Like the wind.
He even mentioned a price. Like, and I'm like, here, and not only that, but it was like December.
Yeah, so you can price it to his needs. Yeah.
And it was December, so they were, Redbubble always does all these code sales, you know, you get 15% off with this code. They Redbubble does, especially through December, code sales all the time, discount codes. So I'm like, and this discount code gets you another 10% off and blah, blah, blah. Did he not respond, I don't think he's interacted with a single Instagram post I've had since. I mean, he disappeared. he might have changed houses.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, he might have sold his house and chopped the telephone line down outside of his neighborhood. He's gone.
Geiger's Law, though, is a truism. Like that reader that's like, I'm your biggest fan. I can't wait to buy this. Oh, boy, yeah. If you just made this into a T-shirt, I'd be right there with you. And then you just hear the Concorde flying to France as fast as they can to get out of town. it's almost the adult version of like, yeah, I got a girlfriend, but she's from Canada. You just never met her.
She goes to a different school.
Yeah, she's a model, so she's got to travel a lot. So, wait, so you do have a girlfriend or you don't have a girlfriend? Oh, yeah, I got a girlfriend. So do you want to buy this T-shirt for only $20? Yeah, absolutely. You make that link available. I'm going to buy it. All right, here's the link. Oh, I got to go. Yeah. Wah, 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 wah. Just tumbleweeds blowing by.
Yeah, so that's Geiger's Law. You can put that down. Now, my question to you is, if there was a Kellett's Law, what would Kellett's Law be?
Oh, God, if there was a Kellett's Law. Kellett's Law would be that the squeakiest wheel in your readership gives you no grease. And here's what I mean by that. Kellett's Law would be that the person that complains the most of, your update schedule is weird. Oh, I don't like the way this character is drawn. Oh, this storyline should have gone this way. That's the exact person that you in your mind, you're like, I want to please this person. They're complaining. But that's the person that absolutely will never support you on Patreon and never back you on Kickstarter.
Oh,
they are
yeah.
the type of person who complains that much and to that extent is the 100% Venn diagram crossover with the person that never supports the things they read. So Kellett's Law would be that the person that complains the most is actually can be ignored almost, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like there's an inverse relationship between the amount of complaining and the amount of actual support.
Oh, you know, God, that's a better way to put it. Thank you for modifying Kellett's Law. That's great.
Well, yeah, because if there's every Kickstarter I've done, if there's something that's like if I'm behind deadline, and that, unfortunately that has happened once or twice. This last one, the books went out later than I wanted them to go. But immediately, you know, the complaints start, and that's valid. If you said you're going to have a book by June, you should have the book by June. That's valid. And if you don't, you should have a explanation ready. But it always happens. The people who complain the loudest are the people who contributed the least to your Kickstarter. The people who spent $500 on an inked commission, they're waiting. They're like, yeah, I know you're going to get it. No problem. I can't wait to see it. I'm excited. The people that spent $10 on a PDF are outside raising the roof. You know, give me my PDF. I spent $10 on you. You know, it's like, oh, man, okay, you'll get your PDF, you know.
So the fundamental point that we're putting out here is that people are terrible. No, I'm just kidding. No, but there is a type of person for whom generosity as a reader is, I guess what I'm saying is if you're not generous in your comments about the strip, you're highly unlikely to be generous about the strip itself.
Right. And it's not really, you know, us taking, although we're certainly being a little snarky, we're not really taking a pot shot because really we're not talking to fans here on this show. We're talking to creators. And the important thing to take out of Kellett's Law is when you get that kind of stuff, number one, like we always say, you have to answer it honestly and forthrightly. But don't let that get you down. Don't let that weigh you down as a creator. You know, remember, a lot of the complaints are coming from the people who are supporting you the least.
Right.
Put
right.
that into perspective for yourself. You know, don't let them talk you into believing that you're a bad person. Okay.
Another way to look at this, Brad, is local politics. And here's what I mean by that. Your city council meets, you know, the 6 to 10 people in your city council, they sit and they meet. And if you're from a smallish town, they have a little place in City Hall, it's a little room. And out of a city of 60,000 people, right, if 10 really loud, complainy people show up to that City Hall, it's kind of fascinating how that can influence a whole city of 60,000, even though the other 59,999, you know, are all content with what's going on. Those complainers make an outside influence sometimes. And so with your work, you just want to make sure that that complainer doesn't have an outside influence on your work. Because the support you're seeing through Patreon, through Kickstarter, through kind emails, through people that you meet at Comic-Cons, and frankly, your own heart with how things are going in your work, let that be the counterbalance against the one guy who's like, I don't like this character. It's always a guy, by the way. I don't like this character. I don't like this update schedule. I don't like this coloring technique. I don't like the way this storyline's going. So anyway, so that's that. That is that.
That's Kellett's Law and Geiger's Law. And now the Comic Lab Law is that we need to address some of these Patreon backers who have some great questions for us to answer.
Well, Brad, I've got a good one for you if you're ready. Can I fire it up at you?
Yeah, oh yeah.
All right, so this one comes to us from Brett Chalupa, and it's here's
Chalupa.
The question for Chalupa, yes.
Isn't that something that you order at Taco Bell? Do you order a Chalupa?
Guess what this poor person has heard 1,000 times probably now.
All right, well, I don't want to add to that.
Although that is like having the last name Moons Over Miami, and you're like, really? Isn't that a Denny's dish? I thought that was a Denny's dish.
It's spelled differently. It's Scotch.
It's Polish, so it has a K at the end of it. Yeah. So anyway, okay, here's the question, Brad. How important is it to have a consistent theme to your output? Is it confusing to an audience for a cartoonist to create both serious narrative comics and a humor strip that are very tonally different? Brad Geiger, I put that to you because you have perhaps the biggest extreme in output of anyone I can think of.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I mean. I mean, he's asking two people that do incredibly wide variety of output. Yeah, like you do a humor strip and you do a humorous sci-fi narrative strip. But those are two very different things. On the other hand, I do everything from very G-rated stuff that can go out on social media to PG-13 stuff to X-rated stuff. I do a huge array of stuff, and I've done humor. I've done journalism comics like Fables, which was just straight up storytelling.
Like journalism, yeah.
I've done a lot of stuff. From my perspective, I have seen nothing but good things from that, because if you create what I hope is good content, that's the important thing. So if you're doing something that's good, that's G-rated, and somebody discovers your PG-13 through that, as long as those two things are good, they're going to like it. In other words, nobody's going to say, oh, I thought he was only doing comics about flowers, and here he is over here doing comics about birds, and now I'm confused because I expected flower comics. No, if those are both good comics, they're going to gravitate towards both of them.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Like Brad, over the course of my career, I have done editorial comics for newspapers. I have I haven't done journalism comics like Brad does, so doff the cap to that. I have done nonfiction comics, though, and I have done a ton of fiction comics, both a very child-friendly gag strip, very child-friendly comic strip, and then I've done a kind of a teen-to-adult science fiction strip that has very humorous characters, but frankly, a kind of a dark plot about wars and plagues and all sorts of things. So, so it runs the gamut. And frankly, I think, as to Brad's point, any thinking, feeling adult will see that you have a spectrum that you are creating in. I think the one thing to maybe be careful of, like, let's say you're doing a horror or gore comic or a highly sexualized comic or a highly violent comic, but you have it far too easily linked in the back of the book of your children's comics or in the on the site that, you know, it runs parallel to the one that is geared towards, you know, 8-year-olds. Maybe be careful there. But aside from that, every adult should be able to roll with the punches, I would think.
In fact, don't you think it's more compelling to find a creator who does a wide range of stuff? Isn't it kind of interesting to find somebody who does this one humor comic that you really, really like, and then they're also doing this steampunk romance, right?
Yeah. Where
it's like, oh, wow, okay, this is good, too. It's just a different flavor of good.
So yes, but I find it both more interesting to see how, like, if Jeff Smith does a serious story like a Razzle, right, and then does a goofy kid strip like a Shazam, it's sort of fascinating to see how that same artist, the same sensibilities, tackles something specifically for kids and something specifically for older people. You know what I mean? It's fun to see, I think, as a reader. But then here's my counterpoint to you, Brad, is that not only is it good for the audience, I kind of think it's good for the artist, because you're sharpening a bunch of different tools that you can use in any of your various output, you know? So, like, let's say you have a very goofy, fun, delightful, all ages kind of Evil Inc. Comic strip about supervillains, right?
Right.
But you've done these serious or darker stories, and then so when the time comes in Evil Inc. to have a hint of a dark story or a hint of a bad turn, you know just how to gauge it because you've done it before in the past elsewhere. You know what I mean? Or when it comes time to have a little bit of goofy fun in Evil Inc. After Dark, which is a not suitable for work comic, you're able to do it because you've done it for kids. So you have a bigger variety of piano keys to play on.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, but like I was teaching a storytelling class at University of the Arts. And I at one point I said, listen, if you really want to know how to tell a good story, learn how to tell a joke. You know, it because the building blocks are right there. And if you can learn how to tell a joke, how to build a joke, you can extrapolate that into writing a novel.
Yeah.
Because they're the same skills. And so if you get really good at doing something on one side, you can take those skills and apply them right over to this other thing, because it's the same skills. It's the same building blocks, don't you think?
Right. Yeah. And it's funny because my wife and I often talk about how a comic writer can write drama, but it's really hard for a drama writer often to jump back to comedy, you know?
Yeah.
The skill set is not immediately transferable. And so it's kind of fascinating how in some ways comedy is a better teacher of writing than drama is. And I say that as someone who has dabbled in both. I think it's really sometimes painful and obvious when you see someone who's always written drama and dramatic writing try their hand at comedy, and you're like, oh, I see what you were doing there, Bob. Maybe stick to the period pieces from the 18th century with the no jokes.
Yeah, you can always tell somebody like that, because it's like the punchline is there's the beginning of illogic there, but it hasn't been worked enough. It's like, hey, I said something that doesn't really apply. That's funny, right? Well, no, that's not funny. That's funny if you take that and ramp it up to 100.
Yeah.
But just a non sequitur or something that doesn't logically follow is not a punchline.
Well, and I want to put this in a little bit of historical context, because so many cartoonists, both of our contemporaries right now, the big pros and the ones in the past, because cartooning so often involves wearing 9 different types of hats. You have to be a casting agent. You have to be the writer. You have to be the producer. You have to be the director. You know, you have to be the stage manager for all these characters coming on and off and framing this story, right? Mm-hmm. Because of that, so many different cartoonists are not only good at doing comedy and drama and high and low stories and you know, adult and kid stories, all that sort of stuff. We've had so many examples over the years of cartoonists who are able to apply their storytelling in vastly different ways, and it's still not confusing to their audience. So Mel Lazarus did Mama and Miss Peach, right? Two of the longest running comics in the 20th century. And he also wrote crime and mystery novels and plays. And Gary Trudeau wrote Doonesbury, but he also did a musical. And, you know, like all these different people have put other kinds of output out there. So not only will you not confuse your readers by doing different types and themes in your comics, you can even go farther afield. And once you've established a toehold in comics, you can do completely different types of projects. So that's how generous I am in what comics are allowed to do, or cartoonists rather.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I have a second question over here from our Patreon backers that I think I'd like to hear your thoughts on. You want to hear this?
All right, let's hear it.
All right. This comes in from Seth Wolfshorndal. What are your thoughts regarding comics anthologies from both the perspective of the creator and the reader?
What are my thoughts on anthologies? Well, I will say this. For the most part, it's not, I appreciate that they exist. I like them. They're fine, but they don't necessarily goose my gander. You know, they don't. I don't know what that phrase is. Goose my gander.
I like goose my gander. That's a good one. I've
is
never
that
heard of
two geese
it before.
Having sex. I'm not sure what's going on there. Goose my gander.
Only during the church bells.
Yeah. I hope the ice cream truck doesn't drive by those poor birds. I like, for example, I loved the anthology of Flight, the one that Kazu put together.
Mm-hmm.
It was evident that they came out of an animation tradition because the stories weren't particularly strong in Flight, but the art was amazing, right? So I loved it for that, the variety and the different flavors that you got. But aside from that, I haven't really read a ton of anthologies. They don't float my boat. You know, that's not what I go looking for in comics. Give me your thoughts real quick, and I'm going to ruminate more on this. Go ahead.
I hate anthologies.
Oh, wow. Yikes. Brad Geiger with the vinegar. Yikes.
Listen, this is me reading any anthology. I'm paging through the book. That looks like a pretty good story. That sucks. That's horrible. That might be good. That looks pretty good. That's horrible. And how you can enjoy reading something that goes from looks pretty good, is horrible. And that's every anthology I've ever touched. I see so much that I'd say, every time I turn the page and come to a new section of the anthology that's not good,
right?
I feel like I wasted part of the money I spent on that book, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I thought this was going to be 25 good stories about whatever. And it turns out it's really only 5 with a bunch of filler that's just not good. And so from the perspective as a reader, I don't like it. I don't like it at all. From a perspective as a creator, I would be worried that either I'm one of the good ones and I'm being weighed down by one of the bad ones, and this is very possible too, I'm one of the bad ones that's weighing down the book for everybody else. You know? So I don't like anthologies. I don't like it at all.
Okay. Well, so you came out of the gate stronger than I did, but here's the thing. Listening to you, I guess I kind of lean towards your opinion, to be frank.
Yeah.
That as a reader, I clearly don't seek them out. Because, you know, so as you remember from my studio, Brad, my podcasting closet has, I don't know, 8 feet, 10 feet of books up to the ceiling.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at them now as I'm recording, and I see out of a few hundred books, 400 books, 500 books that are all comics, I see maybe 3 that are anthologies.
Uh-huh.
So clearly with my consumer dollar, I have voted the way I feel about anthologies. And again, this is just personal subjective, that I don't particularly enjoy them. And I think Brad might be right. I think it might be because it's akin to when I was a kid and I would go to buy a Marvel comic and they would put a fantastic cover artist on there. And you'd be like, oh boy, I'm going to have a great time with this X-Men. This is going to be a great X-Men. Oh. And then you'd crack open the cover when you got it home and you're sitting in the back of mom's station wagon. And you're like, oh, this art is totally different. This is not what I was expecting.
This isn't what I wanted at all.
Also, I hope puberty hits because my voice is weird. So I feel like sometimes, to Brad's point, anthologies are a bait and switch. The cover's going to be beautiful. Yeah. The first three stories are great. And then you just get Johnny Faxted in on story number four. And then Billy tried his best but still stinks on story number five. And then
it's the truth,
you know, and then Greg makes a weird point on story seven that throws off the whole book. And you're like, wait a minute, what's the theme of this again? And so, okay, so that's my reader perspective. And then as a creator, and this is going to sound egotistical, Brad, so rein me in as soon as I say this, but I kind of like doing my own stuff. I don't want to be, I don't want to be a joiner of like, let's all make a project about fish. Everybody has to write a story about fish and we're all going to put it in one big anthology. I'm like, well, I'll just go write a story about fish if I wanted to write about fish. I don't want to do this anthology. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to sound like a shithead, but I would prefer to do my own stuff.
Not only am I not going to rein you in, I'm going to push you further. And the reason for that is that you don't need to look elsewhere for validation.
Oh, is this the equivalent of like joining a fraternity that if I get into that anthology, I've succeeded kind of a thing?
Yeah. You don't need somebody to accept you as part of a group to make you feel as if you are a creator. You're a creator because you create.
Okay.
And you do your stuff and you put it out there. You don't need somebody to say, hey, you're part of the gang now to make you feel like you're an official creator. You don't need validation outwards. Your validation comes from doing something yourself and making that go within your community. You're not looking for outside validation, right?
Well, okay, yes, I agree with you. But now let's try to take an alternate tact of like, what would be the value of being in an anthology or doing an anthology? Because I immediately think like, okay, in my 20s, there was one or two anthologies that I desperately wanted to be in. And I'm honestly flashing back now.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, I wanted validation. I wanted to see myself in print for a small amount of effort that would get me into a bigger project that felt important, you know?
Yeah.
And is there value in that? Like, when you're 20s or when you're starting out, is that why people do anthologies? Because like, I only have X amount of time, so I'm not going to produce a 200-page book, but I could produce a 20-page story, but I'm not going to sell a floppy. Who's buying floppies anymore? But if I get 15 other people in there and those guys and gals create a big hardcover, then I can sell that. And that would be amazing. Is that the appeal of an anthology, do you think, for a 20-year-old?
I guess it has to be. I mean, there's not a whole lot of other reasons to do it. And part of that is maybe you think that you're going to get noticed or discovered. Of course, you know how I feel about getting discovered. It's going to give you some kind of elevation, or you're going to network. I could see any one of those being, reasons, and to different extents, I could see them as being somewhat valid reasons. In other words, if you're saying you want to use this as a networking opportunity or, something like that, you want to elevate yourself to a certain extent. I wouldn't sneer at you for saying that. I could see that. I would encourage you to not spend too much time doing that overall in your career. At some point, you've got to transition to doing your own thing independently. But like Dave's saying, if you were in your 20s and you're looking to elevate, I could see that. I wouldn't throw any stones at you for that.
Okay, so let me ask you one follow up question, Brad, with anthologies.
Yeah,
is it also possible that it might be fun to have a themed anthology because Brad Geiger and Dave Kellett don't have a lot of thoughts about the British Empire in the 18th century, but we have 20 pages worth of thoughts. Is that, you know what I mean there? Like, if the theme is about, I don't know, the civil rights era and the progress made, or if the theme is about voting rights in the 20s, or the theme is about baseball in the 40s, whatever the theme is, I might not have 200 pages of content that I could add to it, but boy, I sure could do a fun 20-page story. I mean, is that the advantage of an anthology to you too?
Perhaps. perhaps.
That's as tepid as it gets from Brad Gagger, everybody.
I'm not going to say no. I mean, you're not wrong. I just don't know that that's as compelling. So my immediate reaction to that, which probably isn't fair, is if you don't have a lot of thoughts on that topic, maybe you should spend your time doing the topics that you have a lot of thoughts on, because that's where your real passion is.
Boy, it's really coming down that we're not fans, particular fans of anthologies, is what it's coming down to.
Well, I got to tell the truth.
Here's the thing, though. I don't mind that they exist. I mean, I'll flip through them at every Comic-Con.
No, I don't. I'm not going to buy them.
Yeah.
But I don't. I'm not going to buy them. But I think they're and clearly there's people who do like them, and I think that's great.
Yeah.
For me, not so much.
I have done this, though, as an author, so maybe there is some truth to the fact that you could get discovered. I have flipped through some anthologies, because sometimes I go scouting around San Diego Comic-Con or Emerald City looking for artists to draw a drive story, or looking for new people that I may not be familiar with. And sometimes anthologies are good for, like we said, it's like, one story's phoned in, one story's poorly drawn, one story's poorly written. But every once in a while in an anthology, you're like, oh, Diamond in the Rough. What is this? I've never heard of this person, you know? But then again, maybe they would have been found had they been doing a webcomic, or maybe they would have been found if they had been just putting stuff up on Tumblr or Twitter.
Boy, are you old.
Yeah, boy. On the tweeters. So I don't know that the anthology per se was necessary in their career climb, but maybe you could argue that that's good for being discovered. So anyway, Brad Gagher and Dave Kellett, two big fans of anthology.
Probably the wrong guys to ask this question.
This was this week's game of Let's Shit on Anthologies with Brad Gagher and Dave Kellett. That's right. If you were thinking about doing an anthology, Brad Gagher and Dave Kellett have some bad news for you. They're not fans. Brad, tell them what they've won if they've done an anthology.
You've won a one-way trip to go home and tell your mother she raised an idiot.
All righty. We'll see you here next week on Brad and Dave Clearly Don't Like Anthologies. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
You know, Dave, there's something that I was listening back to our first show of the new season, and I started thinking we've been talking a lot about what we're planning, what you're planning, what I'm planning, but we should be talking a little bit about what our listeners should be planning for 2019.
Ah, all right.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I'm done with that.
So here's a few things that I think, and you can throw some in as well. Here's a few things that I think you should be keeping on your radar for 2019. The first one, and I think it applies to all of us, and I know it applies to me, is making your site more mobile friendly, or making your, I'm gonna adjust that, making your outreach more mobile friendly. So you need to have some kind of way that people can read your comic on their phones, on a small screen, and making your site mobile friendly and or making your outreach mobile friendly should be a priority for 2019. What do you think?
I love this idea of telling our readers what they should plan for, but boy, did I internalize you telling me that I should make my site more mobile friendly, and I am not reacting well to you telling me what to do, Brad Gagher.
Well, okay, so I've got good news. I've got good news for you. I don't have any bad news. I've got good news. It's not that hard to do. Okay.
Okay.
So there's a lot of different ways you can do it. I know that. I know that as we go forward, things like Comics Press, you know, the WordPress plugin, and stuff like that, they're going to start to bake some of this stuff in a little bit. But even if you don't, even if you are not going down that path, one real easy thing to do is to, for example, I mirror Evil Inc. on Webtoons, on that Lion Webtoons site. And I do it in a panel by panel vertical scroll. And I do a lot of talking on social media and on my site that if you're reading the comic on a phone, that's the place to do it, right?
Right.
So that's part of my outreach for, and I call them thumb scrollers, which is a term I picked up from one of my social media followers that I really think is descriptive. Somebody that's reading a comic by scrolling with their thumb. So that's part of that outreach. Putting your comic on a panel-by-panel horizontal scroll on Instagram falls into this category. That's something you're already doing.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So there's a lot of ways that you can check off these boxes. I've been having great experiences posting as a panel-by-panel gallery on Imgur, which if you're not familiar with it, imgur.com. It's just basically a site, a social media site for memes, but it's very, very active and involved. Fantastic site. I'm having great experiences there. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I love that idea. My generalized advice for 2019, I'm so big at the beginning of every year in setting a schedule and setting a realistic schedule. And I think one of the biggest things you can do for yourself is to sit down and be realistic about what you can produce and what, like, create a baseline of this is the one thing I'm going to do every week. This is the 10 things I'm going to do every week, whatever it is for you. Like, if you have a 60-hour week, I'm not judging you. Set down the one thing you can do every week. If you have a little bit more time, do the 10 things you can do every week. And then, like Brad and I talked about, find one thing that if you get an extra hour, an extra 4 hours one week, you're like, you know what? I could do X, Y, Z, and have that written out and ready to go so that it's up on your wall. So on the week that you do get four extra hours, you go, you know what? I'm going to work on X, Y, Z, and I have it ready to go.
Yeah.
Because if you've planned it out and you've written it out and you have it tacked up to your desk, then when the 4 hours come that you have free time, you're not just going to sit on the couch scrolling through some social media feed
right.
or watching an old episode of Storage Wars. You're going to go, you know what? I want to work on that project. That's important to me.
Yeah.
So frankly, writing down and scheduling out a realistic plan for your day or week in, week out, and then have a little something that's a stretch every week. If you get a little extra time, I think you will benefit every week from that.
That's a great one.
I think for a big one for the year is that make sure you keep your inspiration up. And so somehow, and this is also for me, but I would advise it to everybody. Jake Parker, who we've had on the show, is a big proponent of the idea of the creative bank account, you know, that you refill your bank a little bit or else you have no money to spend. And so if you don't take a moment to read a comic book, go see a movie, or spend time with your family, then your creative batteries are not charged. So I think that's also a good one to schedule into the week as you're scheduling. So that's my first big one for 2019. So far we've got Brad haranguing me to make mobile-friendly websites, Brad haranguing me to go to Imgur, and then my very friendly idea about scheduling. So Brad, what's your next idea?
My next idea is that if you're not already doing exclusive content on Patreon, it should be a priority for 2019. We've got every indication. Patreon themselves say, listen, this is becoming a subscription service. This is what Patreon is really good at. And the best way to drive pledges is exclusive content. You should be using your quote-unquote free webcomic as a loss leader, and you should be using that outreach to be driving people to Patreon where they can see something exclusive from you. I really do think that if you want to take your webcomic to the next level, exclusive comics are going to be part of that strategy in 2019.
I think that's great. Okay, so then my next suggestion for 2019 involves your bookkeeping. And I know this doesn't sound very exciting, but
that's a good one.
Whether you're an amateur, a pro-am, or a pro transitioning to be incorporated, if you take as your final end goal that you would like to be a professional cartoonist working, and usually that means you have an incorporation or a corporation working as the umbrella for all your work. On your way towards that, there's still a lot you can do bookkeeping that makes your tax time and your write-off so much easier. And the first one that I would recommend for amateurs and pro-am cartoonists, and frankly, even pro-cartoonists that that need to do a little bit better with their bookkeeping, is set up a separate set of accounts and one separate credit card that just represents your cartooning.
Yes.
So you can indicate it somewhere, like you'll have your Brad Geiger checks, but then you'll have your Brad Geiger C checks, and the C just indicates cartoonist or something, or whatever, you know, however you want to do it. I had mine set up as, this was back in the day, I had Dave Kellett, comma, business expense, BUSEXP, right? And that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so any money coming in from my cartooning would go into that account, and any expenses, pens, paper, Cintiqs, computers, whatever it was that I, you know, travel for a Comic-Con, would all come from that checking account. And then I would have a separate credit card that would be, and actually you can even do it as a debit card that's Visa-backed from that checking account. And that's all your expenses. That's all your art supplies, your travel supplies, your book supplies, all that sort of stuff for your cartooning comes to and from that account. And then, Brad, what happens is at the end of the year, when it comes time to tally up all your expenses, tally up all your write-offs, it's so much easier. And frankly, without a huge amount of work at the end of the year, you can have a better sense, if you haven't been doing a good job of tracking it, of just going through all those statements and saying, oh, I made X amount of money from my cartooning this year. Oh, yeah. I spent X amount of money from my cartooning this year. And I will be honest that the first couple of years of me being an amateur and then pro-am, the balance sheet is not, you know, it's not anything to launch a rocket over. You know, you're like, oh, well, I guess I made 500 this week. That's okay this year. That's fine. The next year it's going to be 1200. And then the year after that, it'll be 2400. And that's okay. The idea is just that if it's trackable, you can be more mindful of how much income you're bringing in. You can be better in terms of your write-off. So why are you laughing at me?
I'm remembering my first CPA that I went in and had my taxes professionally done. I was doing the right thing. This was years ago. He got done, you know, totaling everything up and showing me how to do bookkeeping for next year, and totaled up what I totally made on comics that year. And he just quoted me the number and looked over his glasses and said, "Not exactly setting the world on fire, are we?"
There was one year our CPA, who I like very much because he deals with a lot of artists, Glow and I, in our growing years, where there was one year where he were like, get done with the books, and he at the end of every session for tax season, he does a little printout that shows you the year before, the 2 years before, and then the current year, right? So you get sort of a quick snapshot of, you know, expenses, costs, all this sort of stuff, but net, gross. Anyway, he slides it across the table and he just goes, well, some years are better than others. And Glow and I went to get a coffee after we were laughing about that. Well, just trying to be like a chipper, helpful uncle. Well, some years are better than others. I'm like, all right, we get it.
So listen, I've got one more I want to add to our listeners' plans for 2019, okay? And that is this, and it's also Patreon related. You should be planning a special offer. At some point, you should be building some kind of special reward that only gets used for that special offer and releasing that as part of like a two-week special offer campaign to drive new patrons to your own Patreon page. We've seen nothing but good things come from the special offer. It's a real big deal. It's something Patreon's doing very, very well. If you don't have plans for a special offer, you should make plans for some time, maybe this spring. That'll give you a little time to work something up. Do a special offer to your Patreon. We've seen lots of great success from it. Don't you agree?
Oh, yeah. I think that's a great little capper for 2019 advice from Brad and Dave for what you can be applying to your own cartooning. So, Brad and I, in fact, Patreon has a whole website and not a website, but a whole page and a couple of videos that'll take you through it. So take Brad's advice, jump over there, watch it, and then stew over it for a day or two or a couple of weeks and see how you feel about how you'd like to do it. But make a plan for summer or fall to tackle that this year, because I think you will be happy with the results.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Brad, I had a follow-up thing that I wanted to talk to you about before we wrap up the show here, my friend.
Yeah, let's hear it.
I was looking, remember we were talking before about anthologies, and I was looking up at my bookshelf, and I'm looking at it again right now. And I wanted to bring up a thought, because this might be interesting to people. When I was a kid, when I was 16 years old, and I was mowing lawns and working as an umpire in Little League to get some extra extra money, not every dollar, but so much of my money, I would bike over to a certain comic book, or I'd have my mom drive me over to a comic book store, and I would drop a lot of my cash on comics. Now I am an older adult of means. I have disposable income, and I personally don't read comics that much anymore. I mean, I'm looking at this bookshelf. Truth be told, I actually do still buy a few comic books at every Comic-Con, because I'm like, oh, this is a good read. But they go unread. How nervous should I be, or what does this mean that I don't actively read comics as much as I used to?
Well, I don't know that that's like a danger side or anything. I don't think that's an indication that you're losing your touch. I think it's just probably that you're in a different space in your life. You know, you're just like me, you're a dad. So when you've got a little extra expendable income, you're probably going to think, what can I buy for my kids rather than what can I buy for myself?
That is true.
And when you're a kid, of course, you don't have those kind of issues. So your spending can be very free. You can say, oh, I'm going to run and blow this money right away. You know, like my younger son is having a birthday in a couple of weeks, and he's already counting up all the birthday money that he's planning on getting from the grandparents and the aunts and the uncles, and planning on his spending spree. And it's kind of like I don't really begrudge him that, because when you're a little kid, that's your main source of income. Is birthdays and holidays and stuff. That's when you get big influxes of money. It's like a sailor coming into port, you know. I'm going to have all this money to spend. And so you can't really begrudge him that. But later on, when you get a couple extra bucks in your pocket, chances are you're going to spend that on your kids. So I don't know that that's a real a big deal. But I will say this. So I did a little side job for a company, and it was basically a consulting thing. They asked me to jump on for a half hour and do a Q&A with them on a video chat. And in return, they gave me a $50 Amazon gift certificate. And I will tell you this, the first thing I did with it just blew that on all kinds of silly things for me that this is just found money. Nobody's even expecting anything to be done with this money. So I bought the big collection of comics by or illustrations by Playboy cartoonist Doug Sneed. Do you know this guy? Sneyd.
No.
I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name right. But oh my God. Can that guy draw? He's amazing. And he's been a Playboy cartoonist for years and years, and just absolutely gorgeous paintings that really I've just enjoyed immensely, just poring over these illustrations. And Wally Wood, they're coming out with a collection of his stuff that he did that's coming out in April, that I went ahead and bought that. So I think what you're going to find, just like me, is that you're probably not going to be the first to spend this money on yourself. But then when you got a little mad money, it's probably one of the first things you blow it on is comics, right?
Maybe, yeah. It's what's funny is when you said, and I got that $50 gift card, and I thought, I'm going to buy little things for me. And for some reason, I thought you're like, and so I got 6 new Smurfs to add to my collection, the little figurines. I got Hefty, I got Smurfette, I got Vanity Smurf. Do you remember
Vanity
when we were
Smurf.
When we were little? There was a brief window where they would make all the Smurfs, the little statuettes. Do you remember this?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember those.
And for some reason, it just made me chuckle thinking of you as having like shelves and rows of Smurfs. And you're like, and so I got that $50 Amazon card, and I went and got 6 new Smurfs. They're right up there on the shelf. I was so excited to add those to the collection.
No longer is Papa standing alone.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I think the truth is that I'm looking at, maybe it's a psychological thing that when I was a kid and the $3 to buy comics meant so much, because that I felt that mowing the lawn and I felt that umpiring that whole game. And I,
yeah,
you know, so the $20 I had, it was such a big emotional part of my life to part with the $6 to get the comics. Whereas now at a Comic-Con, I'll often buy one of those like IDW artist editions where it just shows how John Byrne drew, or, you know.
Yes. Yes.
And those things can be 30, 40, 50, 60 bucks, and I'll drop it and not even really thinking about it, but then I kind of don't even read it. And so maybe it's just that I'm an adult where it's a smaller percentage of my emotional value of a dollar. I don't know. I guess what I'm getting at is I just don't read comics that much anymore.
Well, in general, I don't read as many comics as I did. Nowhere's near, you know, even online comics. I'm kind of like that baseline social media reader that I talk about on the show all the time. Most of the comics that I read, I'm exposed to through my, when I'm doing my own social media work, I end up seeing it while I'm going through that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm always impressed by, as a cartoonist who finds that he doesn't read that many comics anymore, I'm always impressed by someone on social media or someone who emails me and says, I read 100 different comics in my daily feed.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, good. I mean, maybe some people just have a job. Like if you're a reference librarian and there could be hours of stretches where you're not talking to anybody, maybe that's what that person is. Who is that reader that's finding the time to read 100 comics in their feed? But thank God they exist. And it's just, I'm not them. And I was just curious to see how worried I should be that I'm not them anymore.
Nah, not worried. I'll tell you what you should be worried about. You should be worried that your childhood was so darn similar to mine, because I used to umpire Little League games too.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. Now, I got to ask you, there's two ways of umpiring a game like that. Are you an expressive umpire, or are you a laid back umpire?
I was a laid back, as you can probably imagine. Oh. I'm not one to be up there going and, like, you know, doing some big move.
When I was a kid, man, I thought it was my job to make sure that that person in the center field knew that that was a strike. So I did it full volume with the motions. You remember that scene, Leslie Nielsen in Naked Gun, where he pretends to be an umpire? I made him look laid back.
Jeez. I like the idea that you're going to the head umpire, you know, about midseason. You're like, why am I not getting any shifts? Why am I don't understand why no one's taking me for their games. I'm doing a great job. They're like, oh, Brad, we don't know.
It's because it takes you a minute and a half to call a strike. Strike.
It's because you're doing six dance moves with every, you know, foul ball call. It's like,
well, you know, there's a move for every indication. I've got to have a little dance move for foul. I've got to have a dance move for how far it went, whether it was left or right, whether it was a good hit or a bad hit. There's a lot of information. I'm like, you know, those bees that communicate through dancing in the hive.
Yeah, you're like that. You know those Olympic gymnasts, because they're always funny to watch. The gymnasts that, like, whip the ribbon around, you know, what is that called?
I know who you're talking about, yeah.
They what is that called? It's like rhythmic gymnastics or something. What is that?
I
think it's rhythm. It's basically dance.
I just call them the dancers with the ribbons.
Yeah. Now I'm imagining you like calling a strike, but you've got this 20 foot long ribbon attached to your hand, and you're like, strike. And it's just, you know, it's a whole fluid moment. The game is stopping to watch the umpire. He's magical. Oh, the beauty.
I remember one afternoon in June, this kid hit a towering home run, and I put my finger up in the air and did the circular motion. I said, home run! And the whole crowd erupted into cheers, and I turned around and started taking bows before I realized they were actually applauding the kid who hit the ball.
So let me ask you, not having been a power hitter myself, I hit one home run my entire baseball career. How many home runs did you hit? Were you a big power hitter?
Home runs, Dave. I had one hit my entire baseball career.
Horrible.
Oh my God. So let me tell you this. And again, remember, and I say this because I love him for this. My dad was a small town sports hero. I was the first son. I was horrible at his chosen sport, baseball and softball. I was terrible. And I could not hit the ball for nothing. I couldn't hit. Well, what happened was I took a line shot to the mouth, knocked an adult tooth out, and it spent hours and hours and days in the dentist chair after that. And then after that, anybody who threw any kind of a curveball, I was diving out of that batter's box. Because once you get hit in the face, it leaves a mark.
Yeah.
So I was a timid batter, and you can't be that when you're playing baseball. So I'm in, this is high school ball. I'm still hanging with it. We must be beating this team by like 12 because they put me in. And usually at that point, I was probably a junior or even a senior. I was really good at keeping score. I kept fantastic statistics.
This is the saddest story of a baseball player I've ever heard. he's great at doing score.
It would only be sad if my dad had somehow been like disappointed, but he was so like thrilled that I was a cartoonist and so supportive of the things that I did do well.
Oh, that's sweet.
That
yeah.
This stuff never really bothered me. But I'm up to bat. And I still remember my former fifth grade teacher, John Olson, was the umpire behind the plate. And I'm shaking. I'm shaking so bad that I'm rattling my head inside the batter's helmet. I can feel my head vibrating the batter's helmet because I'm shaking so bad. And this pitcher throws a pitch, and I come around on it, and completely by mistake, I connect. And the ball goes sailing into left field. And it is sailing, going, going, going. The guy goes back for it, out of the, into the cornfield, over the fence, gone. Maybe five inches foul.
Oh,
and he called that. And he called that a foul ball. And I'm like, oh my God, that wasn't foul. He's like, nope, that was a foul ball. Ah, fuck. So I got back. I had two strikes on me at that point. I got back into the batter's box. He threw a curveball. I jumped into the stands to sit with the rest of the people. And that was my last at bat in high school ball.
Oh no.
But 5 inches to the right, and that would have been a crowning achievement, or at least one hit.
The confidence you gained from that hit, you would have gotten into Harvard
yes. I would have been, by the end of the year, I'd have been the Brown King with a butter bucket on top of my head.
Butter bucket, to hell with you. That makes me want to hug young Brad. But then you like, you walk back to the dugout. You're like, well, back to scorekeeping for me. You just push the glasses up on your face. Well, let's see. All right.
It looks like the pitcher on the other side just got a much better ERA.
You just turn to look at your dad and you're like, well, back to bunting for me. It'll just be bunting from here on out, Pop. All right, let's... You get up to the plate. They don't even send you a signal. They just yell it out. Go ahead and bunt, Brad. Brad, go ahead and bunt.
Brad, we're going to be bunting today.
Before you even get up to the plate, the whole infield is moving in on you. You're like, oh, man, come on.
Moving in. Half of them came in and started taking their swings for batting practice. They were getting ready to bat. They knew the inning was coming to an end and they'd be up soon.
One guy has a beach chair out with one of those little solar things you hold under your chin. He's like, no, the glove is on the ground. He's not even waiting for you to strike out. He's already enjoying it.
Yeah, it was not easy being me, I'll tell you that. I was not good at sports.
But it made the delightful cartoonist that you are today, and for that, I am thankful.
That's
right. I am thankful for
that.
That's
right. Hey, Dave, we got time for one more question. What do you think?
Yeah, all right, let's do it.
This one's coming in from George McKay, and he says, do we have any great tips for launching your first Patreon? And I want to actually take the lead on this. Are you ready?
Sure. Yeah. All right.
So, George, I'm going to throw you a lot of information at you. Get a pencil. Get ready. Write this down. Comic Lab, episode 50, Pro Tips 47, episode 47, Pro Tips 46, Pro Tips 48, episode 38, Pro Tips 32, Pro Tips 27, Pro Tips 26, episode 26, episode 25, episode 15. Do's and don'ts of launching a Patreon. Every one of those episodes and pro tips have show notes. You can go right to it and find out exactly what we're talking about. And what I want to say in a broader way is that that Patreon Comic Lab page has, we've got show notes on every show, and we have tagged all of the shows. So every show that we talk about Patreon has a Patreon tag. So you go to patreon.com/comiclab, go to the posts section, you'll see all the tags on the left-hand side. Click on, if you're looking for an information on a broad topic like that, click on the topic and you'll see that we've talked a whole bunch about this. I don't know that Dave and I can necessarily go through all of the things that we think that you should be preparing yourself with to do your first Patreon, but we've been talking about it for an awful long time in 2018, and we've got lots of good resources for you. Hit that Patreon tag on our Patreon page, and you're going to see that there's a lot of stuff waiting for you to delve into. What do you think about that, Dave? Is that a good way to do it?
I think that's good. So all the shows that you mentioned, are Patreon specific. Is that what you were getting at there?
Well, the episodes are free to the public. Anybody can listen to the episodes.
Oh, no. I should have said that. At some point in the show, we focus on Patreon is what I was saying.
Yeah.
Okay,
And you can look at the show notes. You can go right to the minute that we start talking about Patreon.
Right. So because Brad has really drilled down with the show notes so that like at 11 minutes and 35 seconds, we start talking about Brad's inability to hit a baseball. So at 12 minutes, right, 10 seconds, right, we talk about him getting beaned in the face. So, all right. But so here's my question to you about Patreon, because I actually don't know the answer to this. If someone were to go to our post page and scroll down so that the last, say, 100 posts have loaded, can they then search the show notes without having to expand the show notes? You know what I mean? The post itself?
I think you've got to click, but it doesn't like take you to a new page. It'll just expand that post so that you can see the show notes.
Right. Is there a way on Patreon, and I'm asking naively, is there a way to search show notes without having to do all that? And there's not, is there?
No. That's one thing Patreon really needs to do is give us a search function. So I could just put in any words, even if they aren't tagged, and have it search through the stuff that we posted. I've been suggesting that for a long time, and they keep saying that they know that it's an issue. I'm hoping that's going to come out soon.
I mean, they're doing so much hiring that you have to believe that there's a lot of development on the horizon for stuff for Patreon. But anyway, George, the good news is we've talked about this there's always more to say. I'm sure we'll come back to it. But what Brad's trying to say in a simple way is that we have talked about this already on 15 different episodes. And so I think to Brad's suggestion, if you go to those show numbers and then search down the show notes, you'll have probably at least an hour and a half, if not 2 hours, just on launching Patreon that we've already recorded. So, and that's true with whatever your topic is. Is it about book publishing? Is it about Comic Cons? Is it about getting beaned in the face with a baseball? Like all of those show notes, no laugh from that. I thought that would be funny, but boy, we're clearly triggering a bad childhood memory.
No, I'm starting to shake again. Making my batting helmet vibrate.
As I say that, your tongue just finds the tooth that it was the replacement tooth, and you're like, this is not funny. I'm not enjoying this joke.
I don't like this anymore.
Well, I can joke around with you about it because I have 4 fake molars from when I shattered them in football. I told you about that one, right?
Yeah. That's really, and that kind of pain is super painful. That's a real sharp pain.
Yeah, when you shatter a tooth, you're nervous. Boy. Anyway, so Brad and Dave Kellett, two athletes ready to face the world.
Face being the operative word.
Yeah, exactly. There's a reason we found careers in cartooning, and that's because we got the shit kicked out of us playing any sport.
Yeah, nobody throws balls at you here in the studio. Gonna leave that one alone, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Well, then in that case, I'm gonna say this. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com, and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my good friend Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab, so we'll say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.
Wow.